Hello, and welcome to the Perspectives in History podcast. I'm your host, Willem Connor. Thank you, as always, for listening. For nearly three decades around the turn of the 19th century, Leopold II, King of the Belgians, ruled over 2.3 million square kilometers, or about 900,000 miles, of land in Central Africa as an absolute monarch. In his mind, this massive territory, which he ruled as his personal fiefdom along medieval lines, had but one purpose and one purpose only: to extract as much wealth as possible, regardless of the human cost. And these human costs were indeed astronomical. The regime of brutal exploitation that was imposed on the Congo saw the region's population decrease precipitously, with estimates varying from 3 million on the low end to 13 million. This remains a highly controversial subject to this day, especially as to whether or not these events can be accurately described as a genocide. In this series of the Perspectives in History podcast, we will discuss the Congo Free State, one of the worst tragedies of the modern age, to be sure. Along the way, we will be introduced to many different types of figures. The intrepid explorers, who were the first Europeans to brave the forbidding interior of the African continent, and who either wittingly or unwittingly served as the vanguard of imperialism. The businessmen and philanthropists, who were convinced to fund this project, believing that they were helping to spread civilization to the unenlightened natives. The natives themselves, who suffered and died under the system of forced labor that was put into place, and who sometimes rebelled against it. The soldiers and administrators who did the dirty work of colonial exploitation on the ground, who burned down villages and severed limbs to punish resistance. The Christian missionaries of various denominations, who went to the Congo to evangelize to its people, only to bear witness to unspeakable atrocities. The journalists who sought to document said atrocities and expose them to the world's attention. And the activists and writers who campaigned tirelessly against the king's personal rule. All this and more will be covered over the five episodes of the series on the Congo Free State, so please stay tuned, and thank you once again for joining us. Before we begin, I have some housekeeping matters to discuss first. So at the time I'm recording this, it is the second week of May 2024, which means this episode should go live on or around the 11th, Saturday. Now, if you're wondering where the final two episodes of the previous series on the Korean War are, do not worry, they are still forthcoming. In the last episode I uploaded of that series, episode 9, I put forward the idea of going ahead and beginning this next series on a regular schedule while I worked to get the last two episodes of the Korea series uploaded as I finished them. I didn't see anyone object to this, so I've gone ahead and done it. Unfortunately, I can't provide any concrete idea of when these episodes may be released, but ideally it will be before the end of this month, no promises. While we're on the matter of scheduling, I should mention that as it stands currently, I'm planning to go on my usual hiatus in June after the last of these Congo episodes are released, but that may be subject to change, and I'll make up my mind on this soon and let you know. Something else that's been in the works recently is a new and improved website for the podcast, so keep an eye out for that official announcement hopefully coming soon as well. So before we begin the narrative, let's take a few minutes to discuss the sources used in making this episode. So if you take a look at the episode's description, you'll see I have a total of six works listed in the bibliography. The two books that I used most heavily in researching this series were Neil Atchison's The King Incorporated and Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost. Neither of these books are perfect. For one, they are both somewhat dated, with the former being written in the 1960s and the latter in the 1990s. Secondly, they're both aimed at a more general audience, but nevertheless, they provide a perfectly serviceable overview of the topic, and actually complement each other quite nicely in terms of the aspect of the subject they devote their attention to. Asherson's book contains a lot of information about the European side of the story. It helps one to understand the economics that underlay the entire colonial project in the Congo, where this funding came from, where the profits went to, and so on and so forth. It also discusses how the Congo issue affected Belgian politics, and quite a bit of biographical information about King Leopold. Honestly, perhaps more than is really necessary, but information that is still nonetheless helpful for understanding his intense personal drive for money and power that motivated much of his decision-making vis-a-vis the Congo. Hochschild's book, on the other hand, focuses more on the African side of things, trying to find a through line from the earliest European contact with the region to the age of new imperialism. It centers on the people on the ground, those who were actually carrying out the work of colonial domination, their victims, and their opponents. Between these two books, one can begin to get a more comprehensive idea of this chapter in history. Michael Rutz's book, King Leopold's Congo and the Scramble for Africa, A Short History with Documents, is an excellent introduction to the subject, I found. The first 20 or so pages provide a broad historical overview, while the rest of the book consists of a series of excerpts from 26 relevant historical documents. The type of documents that are included are rather varied, including, among other things, interviews with eyewitnesses, parts of official speeches and treaties, political pamphlets, and court documents. The book serves, therefore, as a good starting point for anyone looking to do more primary research into the subject. Speaking of primary sources, the main one that I have listed in the bibliography is a compilation made by two historians of Roger Casement's report on the Congo and his 1903 diary. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about who Roger Casement was exactly, since he'll be given a proper introduction in episode 5 of this series. For now, all that I'll say is that he was a colonial functionary dispatched to investigate conditions in the Congo on behalf of the British government. The volume I have listed contains the full report and a diary that he kept at the time, both with some minor editing. The report itself is honestly quite dry and does not make for exciting reading, especially if one doesn't come into this with a moderate level of background knowledge. Still, it can provide one with some insights into the colonial system that was in place in the Congo at its time, and not to mention that the historical significance of this document can hardly be overstated. You may also have noticed that I included Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness as a source here, and may be wondering what a work of fiction is doing in this list. Again, I explained the relevance of this work to our narrative at length later on, but to summarize, it is important in two respects. One, in that the novel was based on the author's experiences in the Congo, and two, that it was published amidst a growing controversy about Leopold's rule there, and played a role in influencing public opinion. The final book on my list is Thomas Pakenham's monumental work, The Scramble for Africa, White Man's Conquest of the Dark Continent. And when I say monumental, I absolutely mean it. This book is over 700 pages long, and as the title suggests, it is not solely focused on Leopold and the Congo, but is instead a study of the colonization of Africa in the late 19th and early 20th centuries more broadly. Only 7 of the book's 37 chapters are dedicated specifically to the Congo, so obviously I did not go through this book with the same sort of fine-tooth comb that I did with the others here. Pakenham's work has been criticized for, among other things, sanitizing colonialism and generally being overly Eurocentric, but personally I found it a helpful guide to placing the story of the Congo Free State in a broader geopolitical context, not to mention that I find his prose to be quite readable. This is to say, of course, that one should read this document, and all documents, for that matter, critically. That's all I have to say about sources for now. So, without further ado, let us begin. Our narrative begins in the middle of the 19th century, the year 1856 to be precise. At this time, Europe was in the process of recovering from the continent-wide devastation wrought by the French Revolutionary Wars and the subsequent Napoleonic Wars. As a result of the 1815 Congress of Vienna, which put an end to these conflicts, the states of Europe, the great powers especially, were eager to keep the peace on the continent and to maintain the pre-existing balance of power. Thus, these European states were forced to look elsewhere on the globe for opportunities to seek new markets, find new resources to extract, and generally to expand their power and influence, thus leading to the genesis of what historians have dubbed New Imperialism, so-called to distinguish it from the pre-modern and early modern waves of imperialism that predated it, and the modern imperial projects that came after it. During the first wave of European imperialism, colonization efforts were focused mostly on the continents of North and South America. This process began with the discovery of the New World in the waning years of the 15th century, and continued well into the 18th. The Age of Atlantic Revolutions, which was kicked off by the American Revolution, but for most intents and purposes, well and truly began with the French, served to break European power in the Americas and resulted in the formation of independent republics stretching from the United States of America in the north to Chile and Argentina in the south. In past centuries, the whole continent of Africa had gone largely ignored by the European imperial powers for a multitude of reasons. Impassable terrain, hostile natives, tropical diseases, and a general lack of knowledge of the continent's geography had all served to make the prospect of establishing a permanent imperial presence in Africa too daunting for most of the colonial powers. But by the mid-1800s, certain technological developments were poised to allow the Europeans to finally circumvent these hurdles. Here, I feel it's necessary to dedicate some words to explaining the root causes of this new imperialism. In inaugurating this era of new imperialism, the culprits were primarily motivated by economic factors. By the mid-19th century, the effects of the Industrial Revolution were beginning to be felt throughout Europe. In fact, it was the Industrial Revolution that served both to motivate and to enable the colonization of Africa. This is something that has been argued by many other scholars much better versed in the subject than myself. As early as 1906, British journalist John A. Hobson theorized that the overproduction stimulated by the Industrial Revolution in Europe motivated European countries to find new markets for their excess goods. At the same time, the demand in European markets for commodities that could not be produced in Europe, such as sugar, tea, coffee, palm oil, cotton, and particularly relevant to our narrative here, rubber, served as an equally powerful motivating factor behind the colonization of Africa. This dynamic explained above, first recognized by people like Hobson and Karl Kautsky, was popularized by the Russian revolutionary leader Vladimir Lenin in his 1917 book, Imperialism, the High Stage of Capitalism. While one might be hard-pressed to argue against the notion that economic factors did in fact play a central role in motivating the colonial projects of the era, a number of other factors must also be considered. For one, as I alluded to earlier, and as we will see borne out in the narrative, geopolitical considerations also played a major role. The principal players in what would become known as the Scramble for Africa competed with one another for power and influence in Africa in order to gain certain advantages over their rivals. In the case of Belgium in particular, we will see how its leaders conceived of their colonial project in the Congo as an effort to cement their place on the world stage. Then, of course, there were more abstract factors, like ideology and religion. European colonial expansion into Africa was motivated by a whole slate of complementary ideological factors based on religious and scientific views. Religious beliefs had long served to justify imperial projects of this nature since at least the colonization of the Americas, and some would argue goes as far back as the Crusades of the medieval times. In this instance, at least, religion served to grant the imperial powers a sense of moral superiority over their subjects. Attempts to stamp out supposedly endemic cultural practices of the African people, such as slavery, polygamy, and cannibalism, and to simultaneously spread the light of Western civilization, were seen as a moral imperative. Christian missionaries frequently served as agents of European imperialism in this way, but as we will also see in due time, the moral consciousness of these same missionaries would sometimes cause them to turn against the colonial project and to serve as some of the most vocal activists against the worst abuses of native populations. This period also saw the emergence of ideas such as social Darwinism and scientific racism, which provided the Europeans with similar notions of moral superiority that served to justify their actions. Ideas such as these combined into something that historians have dubbed the civilizing mission, which was a complex series of rationales justifying colonial expansion, with the overarching idea being that it was the duty of the Europeans to enlighten the savages and to drag them, willingly or otherwise, into civilization. Perhaps the most famous expression of this notion is Rudyard Kipling's poem, The White Man's Burden. Written in 1899 in the context of the American War in the Philippines, Kipling's poem nevertheless offers an insight into the imperialist mindset that was widespread at the time. Quote, "Take up the white man's burden, in patience to abide, to veil the threat of terror and to check the show of pride, by open speech and simple, 100 times made plain, to seek another's profit and work another's gain." End quote. Now, the degree to which the concept of the civilizing mission can be considered to be a motivating factor or merely a cynical justification deployed to obscure the more material aspects of the project that we discussed previously is a matter of some debate, a debate that I don't plan to get bogged down in explaining all the contours of here. But, nevertheless, all of these things are important to consider in tandem when trying to understand the emergence of new imperialism. So, now, let's move on to the Congo itself and the history of the region's fateful first contacts with the people of Europe. Until the early modern period, sub-Saharan Africa was an entirely unknown quantity in the collective European imagination. As far as they were concerned, the region was terra incognita, a place as alien to them as the moon. The temperate Mediterranean coast that comprised the northern tip of the continent was inhabited by Muslim heretics. South of that lay the vast and impassable desert of the Sahara, and what lay even further south was left for anyone to speculate. And speculate they did. Some claimed that the region was host to Cyclops. Others thought that it was inhabited by monsters who were half-man, half-lion hybrids. Author Peter Forbath offers the following description of sub-Saharan Africa in the medieval European imagination, quote, "This was a region of the utmost dread, where the heavens fling down sheets of liquid flame and the waters boil, where serpent rocks and ogre islands await the mariner, where the giant head of Saturn himself reaches up from the fathomless depths to seize him, where he will turn black in the face and body as a mark of God's vengeance for the insolence of prying into the forbidden mystery. And if he should somehow manage to survive these ghastly perils and sail on through, he would then arrive in the sea of obscurity and be lost forever in the vapors and slime at the edge of the world." End quote. The heart of the African continent held many mysteries, some of which, like those described previously, served as powerful deterrents, while others had the exact opposite appeal. For one, there is the source of the Nile River, which had long eluded even ancient geographers. There was also the realm of Prester John, a mythical figure appearing in medieval European literature. According to these sources, this Prester John was a powerful Christian king who ruled over some 42 lesser kings and whose vast empire, somewhere perhaps in the center of Africa, held untold riches. Ultimately, it was the search for a passage to India that would eventually cause European explorers to venture south of the Canary Islands and along the western coast of Africa. The first Europeans to reach the estuary of the Congo River were members of a Portuguese expedition led by an explorer named Diogo Cao in the year 1482. Their presence is attested to by a stone pillar left behind by the expedition, with the following sentence carved into its edifice, quote, "In the year 6681 of the world, and in that of 1482 since the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ, the most serene, most excellent, and most potent prince, Prince João of Portugal, did order this land to be discovered and this pillar of stone to be erected by Diogo Cao, an esquire in his household." End quote. Just to the south of the Congo River lay the territory of a vast and century-old kingdom called the Kingdom of Congo. After a brief and fleeting initial contact, another Portuguese mission was dispatched to establish permanent diplomatic relations with the kingdom. The Congolese monarch was known as the Mani Congo, and the seat of his power was located at Mbanza Congo, a large settlement just to the south of the modern border between the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Angola. The Portuguese discovered that the Mani Congo, a man who at this time was named Nzinga a Nkrumah, ruled over a large kingdom consisting of six provinces and sprawling across a broad swath of the African interior. The Portuguese could not help but admire the kingdom's sophisticated system of government, one aspect of which was that the governors of the provinces and other notables in the kingdom actually convened to elect their own monarch. The Portuguese mission in 1491 had brought with them a number of missionaries who managed to successfully convince the Mani Congo to adopt Christianity. He was baptized that same year and took the Christian name of João, in tribute to the King of Portugal. When he died in 1509, his son, baptized Afonso I, succeeded him. The reign of Afonso I, which lasted nearly four decades, is marked by an initial period of increasing Christianization of the kingdom and territorial expansion thanks to new technologies, mainly firearms, imported from Portugal. But as time went on, Afonso's relationship with the Portuguese became strained. on account of the growing pressures of the slave trade. In the early years of the 16th century, further discoveries by Portuguese explorers led to the emergence and expansion of the European slave trade. In 1500, a Portuguese expedition landed in what is today northeastern Brazil. Before long, there arose a huge demand for cheap labor to man the rapidly emerging plantation economy that was springing up in the New World. At this time, slavery was quite widespread in sub-Saharan Africa, and the Congo was no exception. However, it is worth bearing in mind that African slavery was of a different character than the European iteration of that institution. Compared to European slavery, African slavery was a bit more humane. Slaves in Africa had legal recourse to achieve emancipation, whether it was through marriage to a free person or by purchasing their freedom outright. Still, the existence of slavery in Africa created an entire class of brokers and collaborators who were eager to sell off captive Africans to their Europeans, whose need for slave labor was practically insatiable. Towards the end of the reign of Afonso I, some 5,000 slaves were being purchased and shipped away to the New World on an annual basis. By the turn of the century, that number would reach as high as 15,000 per year. The Manicongo was able to witness the deleterious effects that the slave trade had on the region during his lifetime. A 1526 letter written by the King of the Congo to his Portuguese counterpart reveals such concerns, quote, "Each day the traders are kidnapping our people, children of this country, sons of our nobles and vassals, even people of our own family. The corruption and depravity are so widespread that our land is entirely depopulated. We need in this kingdom only priests and teachers, and no merchandise, save for wine and flour for mass. It is our wish that our kingdom not be made a place for the trade or transport of slaves. Many of our subjects eagerly lust after the Portuguese merchandise that your subjects have brought into our domains. To satisfy this inordinate appetite, they seize many of our black and free subjects. They sell them, after having taken these prisoners to the coast secretly or at night, and as soon as the captives are in the hands of the white men, they are branded with a red-hot iron." End quote. The Manicongo's pleas went unheard by King João III of Portugal, and even a further attempt to get the intercession of the Pope in Rome also failed. When Afonso I of Congo died in 1542, he died brokenhearted, despairing that there was practically nothing that he could do to alleviate the great suffering of his people. Despite a number of conflicts, both internal and external, the Congolese monarchy, established in 1390, managed to survive in one form or another right up until 1862, around the period that we are focusing on, when it officially became a vassal to the Kingdom of Portugal. Despite centuries of European presence in this area, the Europeans practically possessed no knowledge of the Central African interior. The Congo River itself was not navigable by ship, given the current state of naval technology. Any explorer who wished to follow the river eastward to locate its source would have to do so on foot. There, they would encounter treacherous terrain and tropical diseases such as malaria, to which Europeans had no immunity. During this period, only a small handful of attempts were made by European explorers to follow the Great River inland, all of which met with failure. And so, the interior of the African continent would remain an unknown territory to successive generations of Europeans. That is, until the mid-19th century. Speaking of the mid-19th century, I think we should now turn our attention from Congo to a place a continent away, to a small and seemingly inconsequential country that would nevertheless change the fate of the Congo forever, and to that country's king, a monarch whose powers were steadily being limited by an increasingly liberal and democratic body politic, a man whose outward appearance of humility and charm concealed a rapacious longing for power, prestige, and above all, wealth. I, of course, am referring to the Kingdom of Belgium and to its ruler, Leopold II, King of the Belgians. Leopold Louis-Philippe Marie Victor of the House Saxe-Coburg and Gotha ascended to the throne of Belgium in the year 1865. At 30 years old, he was younger than the nation over which he would rule by just 5 years. Indeed, Belgium was a rather young nation, especially compared to its neighbors, and at just 11,000 square miles, it was a small one as well. Consisting of a Dutch-speaking northern half, Flanders, and a French-speaking southern half, Wallonia, the main commonality that tied the Belgian people together was their Roman Catholic faith. The two regions that comprise modern Belgium had endured a long history of foreign rulers. the Burgundians, the Spanish, the Austrians, the French, and finally, the Dutch. At the 1815 Congress of Vienna, the formerly Austrian region, which had been conquered and incorporated into France during the Napoleonic Wars, was annexed by the Netherlands, in an agreement that those present at the conference hoped would help maintain the balance of power in Europe and keep the peace on the continent for the long term. In reality, this state of affairs lasted for just 15 years. The Belgian people, particularly those of the rising middle class, found the rule of the Dutch king, Willem I, to be intolerable. And in 1830, the people of Flanders and Wallonia rose up in rebellion against their Dutch overlords, proclaiming their independence from the Netherlands and the creation of a new country, Belgium. The government of this new country was to be a secular and constitutional monarchy, under which the monarch derived their powers not from God, but from the people themselves. Hence why the Belgian monarch is officially styled as the King of the Belgians instead of the King of Belgium. Following the success of their revolution, the Belgian National Congress invited Leopold, Duke of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, to rule over their nation. Leopold I, the first King of the Belgians, died on December 10, 1865, and was promptly succeeded by his son a week later. The early life of the future King Leopold II was not a very happy one. From a young age, the prince exhibited quite a few less than desirable characteristics for a future monarch. He was withdrawn, awkward both socially and physically, as he is described as being unusually lanky and walking with what seemed like a permanent limp. His parents criticized him frequently for his indolence and lack of mental discipline, as a letter from his mother, Queen Louise, shows. Written to the teenage prince in 1849, it reads in part, quote, "I was very upset to read your tutor's report and find that you have been so lazy and that your dictations have been so bad and careless. This is not what you had promised me. Your father was just as grieved as I was to read your latest report," end quote. As the letter suggests, Leopold exhibited a general disinterest in his education, which as a prince included instruction in traditional academic subjects, as well as military training beginning at age 10. Leopold's mother did what she could to mitigate the rigors of this education regimen and to spare the young prince from the loveless indifference with which his father tended to treat all members of the household. And although it was Leopold who was being groomed for the throne all his life, it was nonetheless clear to him that his parents favored his younger brother and sister more than himself. Queen Louise died in 1850, leaving the 15-year-old prince without the only warm and loving figure in his life. He was now thrust into the cold and impersonal world of Belgian court politics, a world governed by excessive formality and convoluted rules of etiquette. His father, the king, remained as distant a figure as he had been throughout his whole life. If the younger Leopold wished to see his father for any reason, he was obliged to formally request a royal audience as if he were on some official business of state. More often than not, the king would send communications to his son through his secretaries or some other intermediary. It was in such an environment that the future king received a crash course in conducting politics at an interpersonal level. He cultivated a network of officials, functionaries, informants, advisors, and the like, all of whom were eager to win his favors by teaching him the intricacies of the government. By the time Leopold was about to turn 18, he appears to have outgrown his youthful indolence and had begun to exhibit a greater degree of competency. His previous disinterest in his studies gave way to an absolute obsession with matters of geography and trade that tended to strike those around him as peculiar. His father, who, although had never been particularly close with the prince, could observe that he was coming into his own as the heir apparent. In a conversation with one of his ministers, the elder Leopold likened the younger to a fox. Favorably, I should say. Quote, "Leopold is subtle and shy. He never takes a chance. The other day when I was in the Ardennes forest, I watched a fox, which wanted to cross a stream unobserved. First, he dipped a paw in the water to see how cold it was, then he lowered the paw carefully to see how deep it was, and then, with a thousand further precautions, he made his way very slowly across. That is Leopold's way." End quote. In King Leopold's Ghost, Hochschild, commenting on Leopold I's analogy, writes that Leopold II would not always embody these traits, sometimes overextending himself in a lapse of caution or accidentally revealing too much about his true intentions. But, he concludes, quote, "There was indeed something fox-like about the manner in which this constitutional monarch of a small and increasingly democratic country became the totalitarian ruler of a vast empire on another continent, Stealth and deception would be his trusted devices, just as the fox relies on such qualities to survive in a world of hunters and predators. End quote. Around that time, Leopold's father made arrangements for his son to be married. The bride-to-be was Marie Henriette von Habsburg-Lorraine, the daughter of Archduke Joseph, the Palatine of Hungary, and a relation of the Emperor of Austria, Franz Josef I. The Belgian king proposed the marriage on his son's behalf, and the girl's parents gave their blessing, as did the emperor. Politically speaking, the match was an auspicious one, really more so for the Belgians than it was for the Habsburgs. But on an interpersonal level, the two could hardly have been more ill-suited for each other. Marie Henriette was a strong-willed and hot-tempered girl with boyish behaviors. Specifically, her fondness for horseback riding was well attested. Leopold, by contrast, was sickly and unathletic. He was generally withdrawn, and when he did interact with others, he proved to be a poor judge of social cues, making belittling remarks to others or subjecting them to his extended pedantic ramblings about international trade or some such matter. One lady of the court remarked that, quote, "This is a marriage between a stable boy and a nun, and by nun I, of course, mean the Duke of Brabant," end quote. Duke of Brabant being Leopold's official title at the time. Still, neither of the two had any say in this matter, and the pair were married in August 1853. The couple developed a mutual dislike from essentially the moment they first met. Marie Henriette barely tried to conceal her disdain for her husband even from the general public. In a letter written to a friend a month after the wedding, she wrote, quote, "My poor mother is beginning to understand what she has done. She thought that this marriage would make me happy, and sees now that it has done the very opposite. If God hears my prayers, I shall not go on living much longer," end quote. The pair became more or less estranged, and the situation did not change with the birth of any of the couple's four children. So, to summarize, as the future King Leopold II made the transition from his dreary and joyless adolescence into his downright miserable family life, he tried to throw himself into any kind of work that might distract himself from his present circumstances. But he was not yet king, and because his father was only 62 years old and in relatively good health, it would be another 12 years from the time of the prince's marriage until he would finally ascend to the throne. Nor did the king, every bit as secretive and reclusive as his son, allow the prince to gain expertise by consulting with him on matters of state. Although he was not yet the king of the Belgians, Leopold already began to harbor feelings of resentment regarding the country that he was to inherit, particularly in regards to its small size, its relative youth, and its lack of prestige or economic strength. He became intensely envious of his fellow European rulers, such as Napoleon III of France, who freely pursued their imperial ambitions and in doing so, won fame and prestige for their respective nations. It was primarily the sort of national inferiority complex that would manifest itself in the king's all-consuming desire for Belgium to possess a colony. And so it was this problem that he devoted his energy to solving, concocting various schemes by which his country might acquire a colony overseas. He spent countless hours in his study, poring over maps, researching the histories of the British and Dutch colonial empires, studying the financial records of the British East India Company, even traveling to various different locales throughout the globe, all in the hopes of answering one question: where in the world would Belgium find a colony? Even at the time of his coronation, the question still eluded Leopold. Early on, Leopold had looked to the Americas, particularly Brazil and Argentina, as potential locations in which to expand Belgium's economic and political influence. But a series of tragic events in the near future would clearly demonstrate that the Americas were off-limits to European imperial machinations. In the mid-1860s, Leopold's brother-in-law, Maximilian von Habsburg, was selected by French Emperor Napoleon III to rule Mexico as the figurehead of a new pro-French regime. When Maximilian and his wife, Leopold's younger sister Charlotte, set off for Mexico in 1864, Leopold enthusiastically supported the couple, perhaps seeing an opportunity to advance Belgian interests in the New World through his familial ties. But Maximilian's reign as the Emperor of Mexico was not fated to last for long. The forces loyal to the deposed president, Benito Juarez, rose up in rebellion throughout the country. By 1866, the French, realizing that their situation was no longer salvageable, decided to cut their losses and withdrew their forces from the country. By June of the following year, the rebels managed to capture the emperor, whom they executed by firing squad. Fortunately for his wife, Charlotte had already managed to depart the country. She went to the various courts of Europe to plead with them to aid her husband. And her failure in this mission seems to have, for lack of a better phrase, driven the poor woman insane. She began to suffer from paranoid delusions, and following her initial psychotic break, her brother, now King of the Belgians, shepherded her and her servants into a secluded chateau in the Belgian countryside, where she could no longer be a public embarrassment. Although his own sister had become a living, breathing example of the risks inherent in such colonial adventurism, this did not seem to give Leopold II cause for doubt or concern. The lesson he seems to have taken away from the whole ordeal was that only the Americas were off-limits. He would continue his search elsewhere. The next logical places to look were Asia or Oceania, but most of the land here had already been claimed by Britain, France, and others. He presented an offer to the Spanish, who still controlled the Philippines at that time, to purchase the colony from them outright, but he was rebuffed. He also considered purchasing or leasing the islands of Formosa and Fiji, but these attempts also failed. So, if Belgium was to acquire a colony, then the last logical place to look was Africa. By the time Leopold II took power, European presence on the continent was minimal. France owned Algeria, while the remainder of the northern Mediterranean coast was controlled at least nominally by the declining Ottoman Empire. The British had a strong presence in the southernmost tip of the continent, and the Portuguese still hung onto their holdings on both the western and eastern coasts, which would become the modern countries of Angola and Mozambique, respectively. But approximately 80% of the continent's territory remained unclaimed by any European power. Something that had not gone unnoticed by Leopold. Now, the colonial powers had not left Africa to its own devices out of some sense of benevolence. As mentioned previously, there were real, practically insurmountable obstacles that made much of the continent a proverbial death trap for Europeans. However, by the time Leopold had ascended to the throne, certain technological advancements were beginning to change this, making the prospect of European domination of the continent a real and tangible possibility. One important development was the discovery and subsequent mass production of quinine as a treatment for malaria. Malaria had been perhaps the largest obstacle preventing European explorers from conducting expeditions into sub-Saharan Africa. According to some statistics, this tropical disease killed 8 out of every 10 Europeans who dared venture into the thick African rainforests. While quinine did not prevent the threat of malarial infection entirely, it did reduce the frequency and severity of such infections to the point where it became possible for Europeans to explore the region without the fear of near-certain death by malaria. Other significant technological advancements occurred in the field of weaponry, specifically firearms. It would be a mistake to believe that the concept of the firearm was entirely foreign to native African populations. In fact, at the height of the slave trade, guns were frequently traded to native intermediaries in exchange for captives. But it must be kept in mind that native Africans had very limited access to guns. As they lacked the industrial capacities needed to manufacture their own, they were necessarily limited to whatever European traders were willing to offer them. And these tended to be outdated weapons like muskets. The 1800s saw a rapid succession of advances in firearm technology. First, the invention of the rifle, which saw a number of improvements as the century progressed. Then there was also the advent of the machine gun, a fully automatic weapon capable of firing several hundred rounds of ammunition a minute. The first successful model was the Gatling gun, which was used widely during the American Civil War, but the model that would see the most use during the European conquest of Africa was the Maxim gun, invented in 1884. Weapons like the Maxim gun and the breech-loading rifle were what gave the colonial powers a decisive edge over the native populations, and what enabled them to not only successfully take over the continent, but to put down nearly all future instances of resistance to colonial rule. Then, lastly, but certainly not least, there was the invention of the steam engine. On a global scale, new ocean liners, powered by steam engines, drastically reduced the time needed to travel across the ocean, making it possible for goods and resources to be transported over vast distances in a relatively short period of time. Riverboats powered by steam engines would be capable of navigating previously inaccessible waterways such as the Congo River. And finally, steam-powered locomotives would enable more efficient exploitation of the land, as they could transport natural resources from the interior to the coast with greater efficiency. It was with these aforementioned developments in mind that Leopold now turned his gaze towards Africa, beginning to concoct various schemes by which Belgium might acquire a colony there. He suggested establishing a protectorate over Abyssinia, modern Ethiopia. He expressed an early interest in this proposed Suez Canal. But it seemed that Central Africa, particularly the Congo River Basin, held the most promise. Expeditions into the continent's interior, such as one by the British explorer Henry Morton Stanley, whose exploits we will discuss in detail in the next episode, had opened the eyes of Europeans to the prospect of finally colonizing the African continent in earnest. European explorers reported vast swaths of land replete with mineral and agricultural resources, as well as an abundance of cheap human labor that would be needed to exploit them. These reports absolutely tantalized Leopold, as he became single-mindedly obsessed with acquiring what he called, quote, a slice of this magnificent African cake, end quote. But we'll have to leave the narrative here for now. When we return in 2 weeks, we will cover the Belgian king's colonial efforts as he begins to turn his dream of a Belgian colony into a nightmarish reality for the inhabitants of the Congo. In the meantime, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or anything else you'd like for me to address, please don't hesitate to email me at perspectivesinhistorypod@gmail.com. You can also reach me via Twitter or Facebook. Links to both pages can be found in this episode's description. If you enjoy the show and want to help keep it up and running, consider supporting the podcast financially, either through Patreon or purchasing some used books from me on eBay. Links to both of these sites will be in the episode description as well. Anyway, that should just about do it for today. This has been the Perspectives in History podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I'm your host, Will O'Connor, signing off.